Hey folks, and tonight's episode is brought to you by YesPleaseVintage.com. If you're in the States and a fan of vintage and upcycled housewares and clothing, give YesPleaseVintage.com a check for clothing, jewelry, homeware, and some really awesome finds. So go check them out now at YesPleaseVintage.com. And currently, if you spend over $60, you get free shipping on all orders. Hello and welcome to the Asian Cinema Film Club. I'm your host as always, Edward Jones, and joining me, of course, is my co-host, the Professor, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Hi there.
Tonight, we look at Warm Water Under a Red Bridge, a film which it was released in the States would no doubt be called Warm Water of Hell Under a Bridge of Fire and View of Doom. But this is a romantic fantasy instead. So going to be real interested to talk about this one when we get into it. But first, it's time to ask what you've been watching. And Stephen, have anything been honing your interest? Because I've been on vacation and had a lot of high hopes of watching many things, and it came to watching just The Staircase on Netflix. It just
okay. Well, I've got a couple of things. One, following up on a promise that I made from your last 50 movies, you know, that we added to our list. And yes, one was a rewatch for a review that I really need to finish writing for Eastern Kicks. So I'll start with that one. So, and again, it's a film we've talked about before, I think during Anthony Wong month, but I finally got round to watching the new Eureka release of Black Mask.
Oh, yes.
Sort of Jet Li, superhero movie from 1996.
Yeah, didn't we watch this in Anthony Wong month?
You did. That's right. So I watched it then, and the but the only copy I could find, only version I could find, was the American mix.
Right, of course,
with a dreadful English hip hop soundtrack on it, and I really didn't dig it at all. I 2 out of 5'd it on Letterboxd, and even the Anthony Wong connection is pretty. It's only a couple of scenes, isn't it? But I didn't really get it. So the Eureka set has got every version. My understanding of this film is it's an okay movie. If you're a Jet Li fan, you might like it. I think it's got all the problems of every Jet Li movie. That Jet Li, he's quite stoic, isn't he? But he's not got the charisma of any of his contemporaries. He's just, you know, he's really good at what he does, as in hitting people, but he's no Jackie Chan or Donnie Yen or Bruce Lee or any of those guys that have got charisma and a twinkle in their eyes. So I don't really want, or Chow Yun Fat or any of them. I don't want to slag off Jet Li because obviously he's got his fans. I think if you're a Jet Li completist, you might enjoy Black Mask. I don't think it plays to his strengths at all. Karen Mok, who I adore, appears to be in a completely different movie. Sean Lau, you know, is far too good for this stuff. However, I watched the Hong Kong version, which has obviously been tarted up for Blu-ray and stuff like that, and it looks pretty good for a 1996 Hong Kong movie. It just feels like a cover version of a Choi Hark film, which it is, because he's the producer, director, and he wrote it. No, he didn't direct it, but he wrote it, and he encouraged it in one of his protégés, is it Daniel Lee, something like that? It's fine. However, I think the key thing is, if you really do like this movie, this Eureka set has every version ever made on it. Whether actually nuts to bolts proper versions of the US version or the international release, or I think there's a, I can't remember, there's about 5 or 6 different versions on it. Also, there is the complete version where all the cut scenes are put back in, but they're not to the same, so it looks a bit weird. Yeah, you know, you watch it, it's high definition, and suddenly it looks like it's off a found video tape. But I think if you're into it, I think it's kind of interesting, and you know, it's a Eureka Blu-ray, you know, they've done a really good job. There's loads of really good extra features. I'll just say that my old boss at Eastern Kicks managed to get a 5-minute feature on, which is why I've got to review it, because he couldn't review it himself because it would be self-serving. So it's fine. I think I thought it was fine last time. Seeing the Hong Kong version, it is superior because it hasn't got that stupid soundtrack. It's surprisingly gory. So yeah, it's fine. So there's that. The other thing I watched is you're going to be quite, well, you probably know because you've probably seen it in my letterbox, but I watched Evangelion 1.0, You Are brackets not end brackets alone.
Oh, interesting.
And I am intending to watch these four films. So, you know, I did ask you.
Got you hooked then. That's interesting.
Well, you know, at the time, I did ask you, you know, can you come to these cold without knowing of the TV show, the first sort of remix movies? And you know, I understand this is a reboot of sorts, even though the first movie... Well, it doesn't really matter what, because I'm not aware of the original.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter to you exactly, because you're coming to it all fresh, so it's anything that's like changed or added to, you aren't going to notice. It's only when you watch the original series you notice things are now missing or in a different, happen differently. So
that's right. And I've done a bit of reading around, and I sort of kind of understand sort of, you know, a certain character is moved forward into this story that wouldn't appear. There's things like that. However, it doesn't really matter. Because I haven't watched a lot of I'm going to call it serial anime. I know this is a movie, but you know it's very much coming from a serial background. So I've watched a couple of things. There's a couple of anime I really love, and we'll talk about them one day. But I'm probably more aware of sort of cinematic anime, and I also understand that I think a portion of this is mocking, inverting the sort of the genre tropes of these mecha stories. I don't know what else is there. There's is it Gundam? That's one.
Oh yeah, Gundam's another big one.
There's one big example of them. But I get it. It's playing around with it. I think, and I liked the artwork. It had that same kind of choppiness and weirdness around the animation style that a lot of anime does, but you get used to that. Honest truth, I enjoyed it. I was able to follow the story. I had questions.
Okay.
I've got two main questions. Like Shinji, he's such a mopey little bitch.
Oh yeah.
Really, the least interesting character is our lead. I'm hoping better things happen to him, but there are luckily there were more interesting characters around him that I want to know more about. And I sadly know a couple of spoilers, which means that one of the more interesting characters has been kind of... It's a shame I know what the spoiler is. The other thing is, it's just the world that it exists in. So this is Tokyo 3. People just seem to be having their normal lives, da 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 da, da whilst giant monsters attack. So people are still going on the tube train to work or going to bars at night. Yet at any minute, their whole district could disappear.
Because the districts, they all sink into, they submerge themselves. It's all on like platforms, like in Stingray. Mm. So, city drops down when the angels turn up. So, it's a world which has adapted itself, much like when we look at the Godzilla movies, and you know when, like, Godzilla or King Ghidorah shows up and everyone's running to bunkers. The world has kind of, like, adapted to the fact that you're going to have, like, big monsters turn up and destroy your town. So, you've got those, and obviously Nerve are the ones who have been tasked with stopping the threat of the angels.
And I also... There were things I didn't understand, and maybe because I wasn't paying attention, or because I think a lot of information is given to you in there's quite a lot of exposition dumps, but some of it's just been given to you on the screen. So I didn't know they talk about this is the second impact, and there'll be the third impact, and the world will end. But when was the first impact, and what does that mean? And I've got a feeling, if you're aware of the original series, you might be a little bit more aware of some things which are just sort of hand-waved, or maybe it explained it to me in some on-screen graphics I didn't spot. Or
yeah, it comes later in the series. It explains what the first impact was, which was basically the first like apocalyptic event that wiped off, and that's why we that was when they first battled the angels. Now they're back. It's like the second impact.
Right. Okay.
It's one of those shows that you will like be puzzled, and you will spend time on forums, and then, well, people would make you feel dumb for not getting it when they probably spent like another 20 hours figuring it out.
I think I can see that. So hopefully by the time we talk again, I'll have watched the second one. I fully intend to watch it. I liked some of the designs of the angels, and then I was mystified by the design of the final angel being like this sort of pulsing geometric shape. After the first one I met, so the angels are these sort of giant, I don't know, creatures from somewhere that are decided to attack Tokyo. The first one's like really interesting and creepy, and I was fascinated by it. I think the second one is a bit more traditional, but the third one is it the third one or the fourth? Or whatever, it's just I don't know. It just seemed to be like something from a demo scene on an Amiga from 1990.
You see, but there's people who like argue the fact is like you know, it's like the ships in Eve. It's sort of like, oh, isn't it more interesting the fact that like geometrical the like shapes instead of just like traditional monster designs? It's like, no, give me a proper monster design. Don't just give me something that's like Mr. Men.
I'd be all right with either approach. It's the fact that they both coexist is weird. I have a general question about mecha in general.
Yes.
In that, why do they have to be the shape of humans and walk around? I've never understood that. You know, if you've got those technologies, do something else with it. And especially as the guy in the final sort of the final thing is that he has to be that they create a giant gun which he is needed to fire, but you thought surely if they can create a fucking gun, or indeed mechas that are 30 stories high, can't they just have a gun which fires a remote control or something?
You see, you're thinking of like the logical man, but they've obviously got to look at this. It's coming from this long background of giant mecha.
I think that's my point. I think this show is it's poking fun at tropes. It's inverting tropes of the giant mecha subgenre, which I am not incredibly familiar with, other than just a general awareness of it. And I've built a couple of giant mecha model kits from Japan for reasons. That's my knowledge of it. But I did like it because I can see sort of that, you know, it comes with a lot of potential sort of chit chat around existentialism, around religion. And whilst I don't think the first one gave me a lot of that, I can see that it's going to go those places, especially with the spoiler that I know. it's going to talk a lot about, you know, something we talked about the other day, wasn't it? About I quoted a Morrissey lyric about does the mind rule the body? Does the body rule the mind? I know that something like that's going to come along where somebody's mind is in another body.
When you watch the show, it's sort of like follows this sort of like traditional sort of like giant mecha battle the monsters route, and then we get to the final four episodes and it goes sort of off the deep end with like this philosophical and religious sort of like leanings to it, which a lot of people either like or they dislike intently. It's sort of like a bit of a divide, and I think a lot of people are in the show because they like the idea of Asuka, who's a cute redhead who's also like a gung-ho robot pilot. They like. I think they tune in more for her than they do Shinji.
Yeah.
The show also like tries to add that element of realism. So rather than having like unlimited battery life for your robots and stuff, the fact that if they disconnect from the power supply, they've only got so much time before they run out of power.
Mm.
So it adds these sorts of realistic sort of elements to the show. And I think when you look at the reboots, I think it skims a lot of this down and it tries to make it a little more accessible than the show did. I mean, we have to remember with the show, it had the two films that came out there, Death and Rebirth, which one was basically remaking... one was a recap of the series in a real sort of abstract sort of way, and the other one was sort of like a redo of the final two episodes of the series, and also giving us a completely different ending of the series. But I've got a couple of these left to watch. I've only seen the first two. Right. So I've got 3 and 4 to watch, and I'm excited to watch them. I just sort of fell off the track, so I'm going to get back onto the track because we obviously are approaching anime, a month-long celebration of anime. So,
However, I kept my promise that I would try something.
Glad you had a look at it, and
you know, I'm interested enough that I will continue. And I think I've also spoken to a colleague who's very much into it, and they had similar feelings to me that I think I'm going to get more out of it as it goes along. I think
when she shows you your board, it's like Charlie in the mailroom. It's sort of like as he explains what Evangelion is.
Luckily, this is somebody I knew that was into it. So I was quite proudly said to him, "Hey, look, I watched this," and he said, "Yeah, I saw it in your letterbox," and then explained to me that I think he was saying that the third one is the best one in his view. Cool. But they sort of get better, and then there's a fourth one. They've got weird old fucking names, haven't they? But I'll keep it going. Is it going to turn me into an anime addict? Of course it's not. Yeah. But it's, you know, it's really interesting. And it's the sort of thing you can only do in animation still, even with CGI. I wouldn't want to see a live action version of this.
Well, this belongs in that same reboot universe as like Shin Ultraman, Shin Kamen Rider, Shin Godzilla. So you've probably seen that little promo shot of like Godzilla running along with like Evangelion and Ultraman.
Oh, do you think we're going to get one? A Shin Evangelion?
Well, this is what Shin Evangelion is.
Right. Oh, I see.
These reboots, they're all part of this Shin world.
You mean literally. Okay, understand. Gotcha.
So like where they did like Shin Godzilla, that was like their imagining of that, and then they did Shin Ultraman, and they did Shin Kamen Rider, and that was their reimagining, and then when they did the Shin Evangelion is these films you're following through now.
Oh, I see. I didn't realise they're all sort of part of the same...
Yeah, it's the same project. We won't say it's the same world, because... To try and work these things all into each other is just a migraine.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because Shin is just Japanese for new. So, fine. Mm. And also, I'm quite disappointed to see that, at time of recording, which doesn't matter, the Japanese Blu-ray DVD of Godzilla Minus One is about to be released in the UK. Not a sniff of a release date. I am hoping I'm not going to regret not seeing it at the cinema.
Because it was Anime Limited who I think handled the UK release, because we got it after the States. So I will keep checking and I will let you know. But it would be very surprising, you know, since it got an Oscar win, for them just to ignore it.
I say that, of course, Everything Everywhere All at Once still doesn't have a UK release. But
yep. That's an Oscar winner multiple times.
And how long did it take for Snowpiercer to get a release? But it would be surprising, unless some streaming service in Britain has decided to grab it and they're going to milk it for all it's worth, which is what happened to Everything Everywhere All at Once. Amazon got it and it's like still highlighting their streaming service.
It's not even part of their streaming service now, though. That's the thing.
Yeah, so what's stopping them? But yes, so I think I was on Yes Asia looking for something else, and I thought, oh, I wonder. However, I don't have a multi-region Blu-ray player, and I'm certainly not going to spend £67 on it. And that won't have That won't have English subtitles on it. So I am going to wait until...
Okay.
Yeah. So that's it from me.
Well, for myself, I have seen a couple of things, but these are TV related. In the new anime block, we saw the first episode of Kaiju number 8 come out as of the time of recording. The new one is going to be out in 18 hours, so on Saturday. Kaiju number 8, I think, is another show you're going to like because you liked What to Do with Dead Kaiju.
So it's funny you should say about this because in my, let's just say, in my manner of getting hold of some of this stuff,
yeah,
it did pop up in that RSS feed.
Oh, did it?
And I did have a little look to see. It interests me. I think partly because... Absolutely, that What Should We Do With the Dead Kaiju link, once I started reading. So I just liked the name, Kaiju number 8. I thought that was... I had an idea it would be something like that. So, yeah, tell me more.
Okay, so it's set in a world where Kaiju regularly are causing disasters. And at the same time, Japan has set up an anti-Kaiju force who are... If you think of, like, Godzilla Final Wars, the guys in the power suits running around gunning down the monsters... That's basically what we have here. As the story follows, these two childhood friends, Kafka and Mina, who both vowed to become members of this defense force to fight Kaiju together after their town is destroyed when as their kids. Now, as adults, Mina has become the captain of the defense force's 3rd division, while Kafka has horribly failed any attempts to get into the defense force and has now got a job as a cleanup crew. So his job is just to be part of the team that go around and clean up the Kaiju that had left once the Defense Force have killed them. And at the same time, he finds himself via a small Kaiju entering his mouth that he now has the ability to turn into a humanoid Kaiju and then in turn becomes Kaiju number 8. The first episode is only we only have one episode out, so it's ended with him suddenly realizing that he's a humanoid Kaiju. At the same time, the Defense Force are coming to come and kill him. So I have no idea where it's going to go yet, but I'm very excited to see where that goes. It has been a manga that's been running in Shonen Jump for since 2020, and it's still actually running now. So there's currently 12 volumes of that. I also watched Ninja Kamui, which is by Sungho Park, who also gave us God of High School, which was kind of like Rival Schools. Do you remember that PlayStation game?
I think I've got it on the Saturn. Maybe on the PlayStation, but that era.
It's basically a similar concept to me. It's a fighting tournament with different schools taking part. But that's another fun one. That's on Crunchyroll. But Ninja Kamui, basically, it's got undertones of Ninja Assassin to this one, as this former ninja, Hygen, he's been living under this alias of Joe Logan. He's been a farmer, he's been raising his family, and when his old clan catch up with him and kill his wife and son, he sets out on a path of revenge. This one's produced by... Toonami, who have been back in this one, and I'm trying to see who the production company is. And this one's been handled by E&H Production, but it's another hyperkinetic action ninja anime set in modern day. And at the moment, it's again got about 6 episodes out, but I've only seen the first 2. But it's certainly a fun take on the ninja mythos, and certainly if you liked Ninja Assassin, I think you also like this one as well, as it's got a similar sort of hyperactivity to it.
I'm just downloading Kaiju number 8.
It's on bloody Crunchyroll, we're gonna say.
That's probably where it's getting it from.
But yeah, there's subs and dubs of both of those out, so if you don't want to read subtitles, then you can watch the dub of that, and the dub is really good as well. So, but no, Kaiju number 8, I'm excited to see where it goes. As I said, not only because it's obviously Kaiju, which interests me immediately, but just the idea of the fact it's like focusing on the idea of a cleanup crew.
Yeah, I used to like in Marvel Comics, they have sort of in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, they had damage control, which the concept was this: every time the Hulk and the Thing have at each other, or Galactus comes down and wrecks New York City, someone's got to tidy it up. And so it's like semi-comedy, semi-serious, that it sort of fit. But yeah, I like that idea of the cleanup crew. And again, what to do with the dead kaiju is literally about what to do with this devil, although it goes in some other places. In fact, some of the premise sounds very similar of people that have achieved different goals inside that kind of Japanese Defense Force thing. But yes, cool. Definitely that I'm kind of excited about.
Yeah. I'm hoping to also get onto Odd Taxi, which was kind of like a darling of last year's anime block, which features a humanoid walrus who drives a taxi and looks at the people he encounters on his route, which I've also heard very good things about as well. So hopefully I'll get a couple of episodes of that watched as well. But certainly at the moment of the new anime block, those are my two that I'm following at the minute. And obviously still chipping away at Demon Slayer and One Piece, and which is like trying to move a mountain with a teaspoon at this point.
Yes, you are. You've taken on something you're never going to achieve, haven't you?
In one hand, it's good that it's a good story, but at the same time, you feel that because you're in the wake of this big dreadnought of a thing, that you're missing like that fan element thing when you like look at all what the cosplayers are doing and what people are like, the discussion is, because they're like a thousand odd episodes ahead of you, so you feel like a little separate from that sort of fan base. But at the same time, much like with like Dragon Ball, the story is still good enough that you can like appreciate it, your own sort of journey with the material, rather than thinking, oh, I can just want to speed this up so I can get to what's happening over there. So that's a plus. And unlike a lot of American series, it's not a case where it only gets good once you get to season 4. Or the season 2 in case of Breaking Bad, which, does anyone even watch season 1 of Breaking Bad anymore? They just start at number 2.
I mean, season 1 is much shorter. I think it sets the story up, but it becomes a different show. Season two, season three for sure. I am on that. I've been. Do you know the show Lucifer?
Oh yes.
Neil Gaiman's Sandman comics, big influence on me. I never really followed the Lucifer spin-off, so they did. This version of it, sort of taking the broad ideas but turning it into a police procedural, and I think it had 3 seasons on network TV, and then it got cancelled, and then Netflix, big fan backlash, and Netflix picked it up, and they sort of did another 3 series. So I watched the first series religiously because, police procedural, I'm your man, right? just with the added twist that one of them is the devil. But then as the show went on, it kind of that pushes that to the background and actually is sort of a talking more about sort of these sort of celestials that walk amongst us, and devils and angels, and Eve turns up. So anyway, the reason I haven't watched very much is I watched season 1 religiously when it came out and then never followed it up. And it's literally gone from 2 long seasons, network seasons. It's had an extra sort of second life on Netflix, 3 more seasons. It again got cancelled. So I've been watching it, and I've watched season 2, 3, and 4. Like without watching anything else for about 4 weeks. And it's just what I found. I like the show. It's nothing earth breaking, but I'm just committed now. And as I know it's got an end point, I want to see it through to the end. And then you sort of read the Reddit pages of the fans, which is still quite active. And I read that season 6 is a shit show and no one should watch it, and it's terrible, and there's all this So I'll sit through to the end. But what was most interesting to me is that whilst it's on network TV, every episode is 43 minutes long.
You know, oh, yeah.
The classic. As soon as it goes to Netflix, they did this with those Marvel shows. I think with all their shows, you don't know if it's going to be 39 minutes or 53 or 66. So if you're like me and you're saying, just one more episode, you just don't know what you're letting yourself in for. I find it quite frustrating.
Yeah, I've yet to watch Lucifer, but they get down to and cracked in Supernatural yet, which is kind of like the show I wanted to get through, because that's on an Amazon. And I think I'm only like almost done with season one, so.
Yeah, I mean, that's another show I didn't follow at the time, and there's a lot of commitment to go back and watch that, isn't it? And I know how I start watching shows like that. I'll watch four episodes in a night, like I do with Lucifer, but one of them I'll be playing on my phone at the same time and just listening to it and possibly missing stuff. But yeah, I need to get through that.
So it's a Mac G show. I don't think you're going to miss much.
No, I'm aware of it, though, and I'm aware of the general ideas. There's another show a bit like that is Psych.
Which, oh, yeah.
Again, I watched the first season of that, and I'd really like to continue watching the rest of it, but there's so much of it. And it's quite light fare, really, but I kind of like the basic idea. These American shows, though, there's just too many episodes. I know that's why people go for Korean dramas. You're one season and done.
Well, on that note, it's time to fire the projector for tonight's feature presentation, as we look at Warm Water Under a Red Bridge. So, Warm Water Under a Red Bridge, released in 2001, is a Japanese romantic comedy directed by Shohei Imamura, who we previously looked at with The Insect Woman. And this would be his last feature film. And Stephen, why in particular did you want to look at this, or was it just the fact you picked up a copy of the DVD in a thrift shop?
Well, it was. That was the reason. It was a tartan DVD. You know how much we both love tartan DVDs. And so it's very rarely you find, oh, a tartan. I've never heard of this. And I've got to be honest with you, the cover's giving nothing away at all, really.
It does
not. I mean, maybe a little bit. But it looked like a Chinese language drama film, right? And I didn't even realise that Shohei Imamura is the director, even though it's got his name on it. I didn't realise what's his name? Koji Yakusho, who we've watched in a few things, including World of Kanako. And he's like one of my favourite Japanese actors. He's in a ton of stuff. So I didn't know he was in it. So it was all good. But I wasn't expecting it to be a movie basically based on, is that a puddle you're standing in, or are you just pleased to see me?
Oh, you're like our followers on Facebook who've had great fun with this one. Because you ask the good people what they thought of it, and Marcus came up with, it had me gushing. I think we're probably better off getting into the plot of this one first. This one's going to be real fun. This is also going to bring up some real questions of cultural differences in particular. The film follows Yosuke, who's a salaryman who's been laid off from his job at an architectural firm in Tokyo, and at the same time he's undergoing difficulties within his marriage. Now, he's friends with an old man who tells him of a lot of gold that he had hidden in a house, which is beside a red bridge.
The titular red bridge is in like a what's it called, like a like an inn or something, a hotel, that's the word I'm after, but it's more like an Airbnb, isn't it?
It is. But it's set in the town of Hime in Toyama. It's a small fishing town. And when he gets there, he ends up becoming romantically involved with a woman who suffers a curse where she is constantly filling with water, and unless she has, like, carries out acts of wickedness. So then when she's introduced, she's shoplifting. Later it turns out that premarital sex also helps her to release this said water in large gushing volumes, which then flows into the local river and causes all the fish to run rampant, so much to the joy of the local fishermen. And it's over the course of the film that he becomes more involved with her, while also finding a new calling as a fisherman, as he joins up with a cast of unlikely locals who live in the town as well. As I said, this is a film which I think may play differently in its native homeland than it does here, because obviously when we look at Japan, they have that curious children's tale about farting. And I think you mentioned as well that the view of your bodily functions is viewed rather differently in Japan than it is compared to here in the West.
That is interesting. So I saw an article or a video where someone was saying something like that. That I guess we have talked about it before, haven't we? Where, like, Korean movies seem to think people having a poo is the funniest fucking thing in the world, whereas we no one in films ever has a poo in the West. they might have a man might have a wee, but no one has a poo. But they do have a different view. I would say, although the character does appear to, can I say, gush, orgasm, that kind, there's a whole porn
about
women who gush. I didn't really see it like that because it's so ridiculous. My headcanon is that she's some kind of water spirit, which is why her I hate it, some of the reviews call it ejaculate, and it's not that, because it's not coming from there, it's just coming from all over. It improves the fish, doesn't it, which then is, as you said. And so I didn't see it as sex per se, even though obviously our lead character likes having sex with her because of this.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's this is presented to the Western eyes that she's a squirter.
That's it. I was trying to find, but I don't know if that's quite what's happened. But then Japanese approaches to we've talked about it before. It's really weird. It's not just about bodily functions. It's about sex, isn't it? And like, it's such a conservative country about so many things that, but their porn industry and their approach to sexuality in media, if not in action, is way different to ours. You know, you can get 2-hour long videos about businessmen groping women on trains.
They certainly do have a leaning towards a lot of different kinks and interests. I mean, yes, you mentioned already about the idea of public groping is very popular in there, that we've all heard the tales of the schoolgirls' underwear in vending machines. For example, we saw the Risque Japan show on Netflix as well.
Indeed. And of course, you know, some of our favourite directors, people like Takashi Miike, Visitor Q, right, is a film which involves an adult woman giving her milk to grown-up people, amongst other things. And lots of his movies have crazy shit like that, and it just comes from this. I don't think it's an everyday thing for everyday Japanese people, but I think there is this sort of subculture, counterculture kind of thing, which likes to play with taboos. And obviously that's where that comes out in the porn industry. And I think this movie plays into that a little bit, But I wasn't. I don't see this as a dirty movie. Does that
No. This isn't certainly in, like, you know, in the realm of the senses, or if we, like, look at something like the works of Satoshi Kon, for example. It's not, like, leaning into that. We're not, like, looking at anti-porno here, which I know, obviously, is it would be, like, Korean, but at the same time, it's sort of, like, the Asian cinema approach to sex and sexuality. And certainly when it comes to Japan, the censorship means that a lot of things are twisted sort of further when we take on the idea that Japanese censorship means that private areas are often blurred, so you won't see genitalia, and get around the idea of, because you can't show a penis, but you can show a tentacle, and that's why that demon school
hentai. All the hentai stuff.
That's right. You see, like, a lot of the demons with, like, and tentacle porn, which is sort of like a way to get around that. And a lot of those titles, stuff like L.A. Blue Girl, which are designed really for sort of like love hotels and sex cinemas, that are shown over here like they're just normal anime, and it's really not the case. So there's been a lot of misunderstanding of, like, how certain things are presented in Japan, especially if you're, like, a kid growing up in the 90s and being exposed to this. But when you look at One More Turn to Red Bridge, it's certainly got more romantic leanings than being about sort of filth and kink. It just happens to have this sort of, like, exaggerated gashes of water that are just going everywhere. When
And I think there's other taboos that it plays with. For example, he's a married man. You know, Japan is still a country, certainly in 2000, in the early 2000s. Divorce is not something undertaken lightly. Not having a job, being an unemployed salaryman. I mean, you know, we've seen it several times, that trope of the Japanese citizen who pretends he still goes to work every day. You know, this is playing into lots of societal taboos. And actually, one of the most interesting ones I saw in this is that one of the characters from this crazy town is a black man. When did you last see a man from Africa in a Japanese movie? And it does some quite interesting stuff with it, like the local villagers are quite racist towards him, but our lead character actually shows him some interest, and then they have a lovely sort of, there's a running joke. He's an athlete, isn't he? He's been bought in
to, he's an athlete with three wives and 16 kids.
And he's gonna be the president of his country one day, and our lead character's gonna be, he calls him minister, doesn't he? And the reason that made me laugh was, and I'm sure this joke isn't just aimed at me, but I used to work with a fella called Ola from Nigeria. And he was a lovely chap, really big booming voice, completely at odds with how he looked. And he took, I know you joke and call me the professor, but he took to calling me Lord Palmer. I don't know where it came from, but I'd walk into the office and he'd be sitting there and he'd turn around on his chair and he'd go, and this is an impression, this is literally what he sounded like, this is not a racist stereotype, but, ah, Lord Palmer, how fares thee today? When he started calling in the film minister, I just thought of Ola so much. I guess it's kind of, again, it's slightly, but I just thought it was lovely to see a black person in a Japanese movie, because it's obviously famously a country which doesn't have a lot of immigration. It's famously a country, I mean, I think I've talked before about some of the documentaries I've watched about some of the immigrants and how badly they're treated, about how badly treated, like, you know, the half-caste people are, Hafus. And just to see a genuine black person from an African country be in this place, get somewhat integrated and have some of the best lines, was amazing. But I think this is a film about lots of taboos, but they're kind of all very gentle, gently approached, and maybe a bit overwhelmed by the squirting.
It's true, and certainly you mentioned about the locals' approach to him, the fact he doesn't speak Japanese and he's there using a net, which they take offence to, because he hasn't got the right sort of permits for using a net. You've got to, if you want to fish, you've got to use a line and rod. It also brings to mind, like, especially growing up in Como, which is all small villages, and there's not a lot of cultural mixing in Cornwall. Mm. I mean, as I said, it's just the way it was when I was growing up. There was no ethnic diversity at all. It was just predominantly white. And when I left, I think we'd started to get some Asian families that had moved in and started setting up shops and things. So we were finally getting that. But when you're in a predominantly white area or any particular area, you will find that people are very openly racist because no one's there to keep them in check. So,
and I guess the point is that what's our lead character called again? What's his name?
Yosuke.
Of course, he is from he's from Tokyo. So I guess I still don't think there's a lot of black people in Japan, period. But I guess he is a little bit more open to other people. He's the one who immediately steps to, is this, what's the harm if you just let him catch a couple of fish?
Yeah, because you gotta like look at it like if he was like, he's coming from like Birmingham or London, which would be the equivalent for ourselves, where you're gonna have diversity and multiculturalism, and then he's going to basically Cornwall, which doesn't have these things. So as I said, people are a little backwards, also very working class. There's no sort of like wealth in this town. They're all, as I said, they're all fishermen in particular in this town, and this is the group that he finds himself becoming involved with. And all the fishermen seem to have caught on to the fact that this is a really good spot as well to be fishing by this bridge, because when her waters meet with the waters of the stream, it creates this sort of perfect breeding ground for
the fish.
Well,
it's special, isn't it? Because it's by the sea. So under that bridge is where the seawater from the sea and the fresh water from the mountain streams kind of mixes. And also there's a little runoff. The drains from her house is where her waters mix. So it creates this amazingly fertile area for fish. There's a lovely scene, isn't there, where they sort of catch... One of them catches a flounder. You can't catch a flounder here. And of course you can't. You don't catch flounders in rivers. And then another one catches
one
a gigantic eel.
One of them mentions
he
gets an eel, which obviously just felt like a nod to his previous film, The Eel. So
absolutely. And I think, did the third one catch it? Or he just goes... But yes, it's just lovely. And I'm no great fisherman or anything like that, but I get it, what they were trying to do. But I just thought it was really interesting. All these taboos are here, but they're just gently prodded, paraded. Nothing special. Even later on, isn't there? There's talk of a previous drifter who came to town, and maybe he murdered someone or something like that. But it's just not really. I mean, it does actually play a part in the later plot, but you know what I mean? There's just sort of the stuff. It's not quite Twin Peaks, but it's got that sort of.
Oh,
thing going down.
Yeah, yeah, the idea of small town quirkiness.
Mm, absolutely. And I really enjoyed that aspect of it more than I thought it would. Although it's not totally overplayed. Characters are comic, but not caricature, if that makes sense.
No, I mean, the film itself, the plot is very sort of thin. It's more a sort of slice of life that just has these fantastical elements in it. And certainly the relationship we've seen between Yosuke and Seiko, who's played by Shimizu Miza, is very touching. They have a nice and sort of relationship, and we see them, obviously, the fact he's not fazed by her condition. And as you said, he in a way is appreciative of it. And while we obviously have said that this isn't like a smutty film, there are people, because this film is available on YouTube as well, there is people who have actually bookmarked all the naughty scenes in the comments section.
Really? I mean, they're barely naughty. It's a 15, for God's
there's,
sake.
There's three know. Of them, and someone clearly wanted to make sure that they could get to those bits.
I mean, if you want to watch porn, there's better porn to see on the internet.
I was just curious,
this movie.
Like, why are these timestamps here? Are they like marking where they were in the film? And it's like, they're clicking them, and it's like, I see.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of boobies, and there's some bums, and that's about it. There's a weird scene, actually, quite early on, where he dreams of her and she's like in a bubble but naked, and it feels like it belongs in House rather than how, you know, House Suit.
It does
than,
have that
this
sort
movie.
Of fuzziness to it, doesn't it? That yeah, House has and
that kind of surreality of it. But I mean, this is a sort of a gently surreal movie. There's another so the girl. It's like she's got she looks after her senile grandmother.
Oh yes, Mitsu.
Yeah, who? Well, maybe she's senile, maybe she isn't. But she's also a fortune teller, and so at any moment of the day, she might have to get her her scribing tools out to pronounce some bit of fortune telling wisdom. But it I know, and it turns out later on that actually she was great friends with the guy that basically sent. Well, we say great friends. Potentially, she's the mother of. The is it called the professor, the guy that died at the beginning that.
Oh,
that lived
Taro.
On the boat. Taro. I think he's known as the professor, or the blue professor, or something. But he has clearly had a relationship with her in the past, and they might be the parents of. They can't because she calls her grandmother. I don't know. Doesn't matter. It's just that
I know she.
She acts like she's, you know, she's got senility, but actually, at times, she's quite on the ball, and she has one scene later on with the smelly tramp that actually shows she's quite cogent. And then when she passes that message on, that's as she passes away. But.
It's such an afterthought, though, the grandmother's demise in this film. It's so because it comes to the end credit, and it's also playful laughs, which is so bizarre because the whole finale where we obviously have our couple, they like get together and we end in this orgasmic rainbow, literally. While in the sea defences, which I've got to say isn't probably the smartest of places to be canoppling, but.
Yeah, there is. So, as you rightly say, there isn't a lot of plot here. Man loses job, travels to village to potentially find a gold statue, meets crazy people. Right at the end, there's some conflict where some of Asako's history comes out, and he gets a little bit jealous. But basically. It's only because they love each other that there's a short conflict, and you're right, and then they fucking create a rainbow, and that there's a weird fight scene with some people that is just a bit weird. And
I think this really is the problem with the film. Anything. It's so thinly scripted. In terms of what's happening, I mean, obviously the main gist of the film is, you know, it's a boy meets girl with fantastical elements added to it. And at the same time, we're also throwing in these other sort of like slice of life dramas about the local fisherman and the effect that obviously her waters of life are bringing to the town. It's sort of like by her finding this happiness, it's like reviving the town in many ways. And we also see flashbacks of how she's like stuff, how it's really kind of like this curse that's linked to her mother drowning. And that it could be like seen as this pent up emotional river that's sort of like brought up in her because of her inability to deal with these feelings. So there's various ways you can read the fantasy elements of this, but ultimately it is just it's a boy meets girl sort of story.
With added magical realism, right? I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah, and I just can't help but wonder how much of this is sort of like lost in the translation from east to west here. Is this something that's going to be playing in Japan completely different than we're viewing it here in the West?
And I think you're absolutely right. You know, all those things that I was pointing out around taboos probably wouldn't feel like a taboo. Ooh, someone's getting divorced. Big fucking deal, right? What was the other things I was talking about? Even the sort of, having sex before you're married. Big fucking deal. But I think it probably was, especially in small town Japan. But it is, again, I'll reiterate, it's still an incredibly conservative country. You know, there's a black man in town. Oh, this is terrible. But although, if you look at the press in our country now, that apparently is terrible. Yeah, I think you're right. I think there is a time and a place about this movie, and I'm surprised it's won. It won like a film for it. It entered into Cannes, didn't it?
It won at Cannes, but it's also entering into Cannes with Miura's legacy to it, because not only, I mean, he did like Black Rain, he did The Insect Woman, so he's got this incredible legacy of films, and Cannes tends to look at your legacy and likes to honour directors' legacy, and that's why you see people like Coppola and Scorsese being like so honoured there, because it's Cannes is sort of like the... They have more leaning into the artsy side of things, don't they? So they like things with some like dramatic flavor, even though this seems a little out of left field for them. But in many ways, it kind of reminds me of that Kappa movie, Underwater Love.
Do you know, it's very funny you should say that, because the same. They both feel like little sort of fairy tales. Now, Underwater Love, well, they're technically a German movie. Is it directed by... an Australian.
Well, at least through Fairwinder Films.
I do love... I've got the soundtrack album. Which, that involves a Kappa having sex with people who has a rotating dildo penis.
yeah, I mean, that one isn't as sweet with things, yeah, but I just...
But I think they're both... I agree with you, because they're both very water-based. And I think, again... You know, we've seen in those horror movies things like Dark Water. Water is an important metaphor in Japanese cinema. And they are both use sex as it, and they both tell a fairy tale. I tell you, it also reminds me of when we watched, I mean, it's a Thai movie, but, you know, Uncle Bonhi, where there's that story about the princess and the...
it's the princess and the carp, isn't it?
And the carp, yeah, which again is a sexual story about...
What is it with this show?
Water just, creatures.
Whatever we do, we end up finding kinky sex movies and penis trauma.
I do think water sex movies and penis trauma are our hashtags for the win.
There again, our anti-porno episode's still missing off iTunes. They censored it without even letting us know.
I mean, yeah, it's funny. About Underwater Love. Underwater Love fits in this. Well, it's clearly a Japanese movie for Japanese people, starring Japanese people.
It's that folklore, isn't it? It's like when we look at the Tanakis in that Ghibli movie, which is the name eludes me now.
Which one?
The ones with the shape-shifting raccoons.
Crikey, what is it?
Pompoko?
Pompoko, yes.
Yeah, Pompoko, yes. With the Tanaki. There's lots of these like Japanese mythology that appear in these films, which, as I said, is sort of like, if you're up to speed on these things, seems like pretty sort of like normal things to go to. It's just, as I said, they just seem more dramatic because, as I said, it's not our sort of speed. It's also a different culture, and as we mentioned at the start, this just their approach to bodily functions, or certainly what it is supposed to represent here. But we hear, and several members of our audience who have seen, read it as something very different.
Yeah. Again, I was thinking. Do you remember A Company of Wolves? Is it Neil Jordan?
Yeah.
Which is a film about menstruation.
So's Turning Red.
Oh, absolutely. Fantastic movie, Turning Red. Again, Turning Red's one of those ones I wish we could cover on this show. Although we could cover it on the World Tour, because it's technically Canadian. But I won't give us ideas on that. But the very few Western films deal with bodily functions in that way. I talked about poo earlier, menstruation and semen and... urine. We just don't talk about it. It's just not polite. Yeah, this movie doesn't mind. It also doesn't mind flapping fish about at the fish market. Like, this is
Japan is also host to the The Gas We Pass, the story of farts, which was first published in 1978, with the American edition being published in 1994. The book tells children about flatulence, and it's completely natural to do, and the cover has an elephant's backside on it.
Yeah, but we wouldn't. We don't talk about farts. It's impolite, isn't it? You know, I think.
Oh, there's a Japanese book called The Fart.
Yeah, but it's just interesting. Yeah, that they just for a country that is so conservative, that they find it happy to talk. I mean, I'm sure everybody's not happy to talk about it, but the fact that there is the opportunity for people to talk about that, I find is. Is fascinating.
It's often the case that when we look at countries which we assume to be very sort of proper and very sort of regulated, that they will often have this side to them. I mean, Britain has its own sort of history of these things. We only need to look at the fact that Peter Jackson's Brain Dead, or Dead Alive, at least in the States, was released completely uncut over here compared to the States, which had cuts. So while we're obviously seen as being, you know, very stiff lip and prim and proper, the fact that, you know, we got the full uncut version of Dead Alive, unlike you guys, and we got Battle Royale years before they did.
I mean, we could talk a lot about sort of weird dichotomies in British society as well, about how we are very, something which came up recently, you know, we have people say, oh, free speech, you should be allowed to do this. We don't have free speech in the UK. There's no law enshrining the ability to have free speech.
No. We live in an Orwellian nightmare where we're the most observed country in the world.
we are, absolutely. And we have, so there's more cameras per square inch watching us. We don't actually have the rights to free speech. And we still have some quite draconian laws around gender, around homosexuality, you know, like we talked about in our Pet Shop Boys episode of the World Cinema Film Club, depending which order these all come out in. That's probably something to come, isn't it?
Yeah.
but we are quite a conservative country compared to many. And then so is a lot of America. Yeah, I think you have a very different experience living in New York than you do in Little Rock, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. New York's like London. It's completely different. When you get into New York State and you go to places like Swan Lake, which is like 2 hours outside of New York City, it's light and day. It's all rural and country folk. And then as I said, when you're in New York, it's like street theater. So everyone's telling you that they're walking here and they're shouting at you all the time. That was my experience anyway. But then again, it's such a pressure pot. It felt like to my British sensibilities. Japan, I'm just looking up this up now. Japan also has a children's book story called The Butt Detective, a walking, talking tush that solves mysteries and farts in the faces of culprits. And every book title begins with the word fart fart. So there's a fun wormhole for you to go down.
Yeah, I do, you know what? I'm probably not going to go down the whole fart route, but you never know. Maybe that's a new list, on Goodreads I need to set up. Right?
Yeah. Anything else you want to bring up on this one? I found it a very middling film, so I only gave it 3 out of 5 on my Letterboxd review. I mean, while the film was certainly watchable, it didn't really give me anything to get particularly excited about. And I was kind of like grateful that it didn't sort of dawdle as much as it does. There's some interesting ideas here, but at the same time, I just feel that something was being lost in translation, and much like the sort of paper thin sort of plotting of the film. So the slice of life didn't sort of engage me as much as other similar sorts of films. So to give it like a Western comparison, like something like The Florida Project, Which is something I also watched this week and just found that approach to the slice of life format a lot more engaging than what I was getting from this small town fishing village. What about yourself, Stephen?
Probably not too dissimilar. I've given it a 3.5, right? Because I did find it charming. I was excited to see a black person in a Japanese movie. I did like the whole fairy tale elements of it. Was it 20 minutes too long? Absolutely. Is it lacking a genuine through story that I could get excited about? No, it didn't. It just felt like I was visiting this small town and there were some crazy kids there and there's some funny stuff. And it was well acted. I didn't think there's anything too exciting in the cinematography, anything like that. It was just perfectly fine. And in a way, I know it wasn't a Tartan Asia Extreme. It's just a Tartan video.
Yeah.
But I think I was a little bit disappointed, especially when it says contains some strong sex and language in the censorship box, and I'm not sure that's strong sex. I don't know. Maybe I've lived in too extreme a world, but I thought it utterly fine. I don't mind having seen it. I'm not going to throw it away. I'm not going to go and take it back to the charity shop.
Demand your 50p back.
Yeah. It makes me interested to see other Shohei Imamura's movies. Like, we have only watched The Insect Woman, which I think we enjoyed. Very different movie. very, very different movie. I want to see The Eel still. That's meant to be the classic, isn't it? But yeah, it was perfectly fine.
Well, that brings us to the end of tonight's episode. Thank you as always for listening. Before we go, a couple of things that I've got to bring up at the start of the show. First off, congratulations to Yuko Shimizu, whose work you probably recognize from the Godzilla Criterion Collection. She did the cover illustration and is now being inducted into the Illustrators Hall of Fame. So congratulations to her, and I'm really hoping Criterion are making her their first call when they go on to do the other two volumes for the Godzilla collection. Also, congratulations to Will of Exploding Helicopter, who was featured in the Guardian's Best Podcast of the Week. A very worthy inclusion. If you're not familiar with Exploding Helicopter, Will is currently charting every single film which features an exploding helicopter, or a chopper fireball, as he calls it, with over more than 800 films currently logged, covering everything from the Lego Movie to American Ninja 4, The Annihilation. He also introduced me to the film Raging Fire, which featured Abdullah the Butcher and a helicopter being taken out by a tomahawk, in a really fun movie I'm hoping to bring to the show at some point. But he also has a podcast series as well, which you can find where you find all your good podcasts, which is also worth a listen as well, as he regularly works with Mr. Rehack, who hangs out here when we do Kaiju Christmas. So those are big shout outs to them. It's also my turn to pick next week, and it's going to be a double feature because we have got a round of listener roulette, which is going to be coming from Marcus, so look forward to revealing what that is. And for my pick, though, I'm going to hopefully go with something lighter, because every time we try to go for something we think is going to be lighter, it's turned into a philosophical nightmare. But we're going to be looking at How to Use Guys with Secret Tips from 2013, directed by Lee Won-suk. This is a Third Window Films release, in which a commercial director, Choi Bo-nan, is tasked with doing anything and everything at work. And due to overwork, her appearance is always a complete mess, and she hasn't dated in many years, is the synopsis from Letterboxd. So
you haven't seen this?
I've never seen this one.
It's one of my favourite movies.
I wasn't sure you'd seen it, because you've not logged it on Letterboxd.
So. I haven't logged it in Letterboxd. I saw this at the Korean Film Fest, London Korean Film Festival, about eight on, well, when it did come out, 2013, so you probably saw it 2013 2014. It's also known as Men's Manual,
right,
in some places. I saw this at the cinema in London, loved it. I've got the Third Window DVD of it. I'm a huge fan of the lead actress, what's her name, huge fan, I don't know her name, Lisa Young, who is in another great film called Killer Toon, which I think she made a year later. And I think I talked about No Mercy, a couple of, which is one of these revenge movies, a little while ago. She's in a bunch of other things that divide me, but yeah, she's also, I mean, her Letterboxd says she's an amateur boxer. I think, I can't remember if she's a boxer or a wrestler. I think she's a boxer. She is a really interesting character. This, I think, is a really funny movie. However, we may be in the same sort of cultural dissonance mode, as I'll be fascinated. But I'm so glad you picked it. Have I not put it in our top movies?
No, I don't believe that we have.
God. So. Oh, spoilers. Stephen fucking loves this movie, but now realises he probably hasn't watched it for nearly a decade. So you've actually made my week, Elwood.
Oh, that's good.
Because I'm really excited about watching it. And I'm really glad. Just had a look at Lee C. Young's Letterboxd page, and that she's actually been in other movies, because I was afraid she'd only been in three movies ever. But and she was going to be somebody that we never saw again. But yeah, this is this. Hopefully, I really hope you enjoy it. But it's a lot of fun.
Lovely. So that's obviously coming up on our next episode. Make sure you look out for that. If you haven't done already, please do hit the like and subscribe button wherever you happen to be listening to us. Please leave us a review. It all helps raise the profile of the show. You can check out our full archive of episodes at asiancinemafilmclub.wordpress.com, and you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Threads. Come say hi to us there, and let us know your thoughts on this film or any films that you think we should be checking out. We always appreciate the recommendations. But so make sure you join us next time for How To Use Guys with Secret Tips. But until then, good night. Hey! 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 昨日の恋は忘れて、昨日のあの子は忘れて、踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。月が砕け散っても、星が燃えて落ちても、踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。胸に刺さった恋の刃が燃える思いを狂わすのさ。昨日の恋は忘れて、昨日のあの子は忘れて、踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.